Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively the Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
I loved being on stage with a mad punk audience pogoing away. You may think I'm wacky in the experiences I've had. Robert is exactly the same. Every barrier I come up against, I will push back. Two girls would take me into that Wendy house. They would remove their shoelaces and strangle me till I lost consciousness. I never knew I was disabled. The thing about disability is you don't know you have it until other people treat you as if you're disabled. She'd witnessed her father murder her mother. My diary's empty. I'm going back to the UK. I'm going to meet my wife. He knew.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
I want to start with your childhood. We are formed from our childhoods, often, you know, and you know, I'll tell you a little bit about mine in a minute as well. Your father was a businessman. Your mother had been a dancer. And what's written in Wikipedia is that she gave up dancing to have a family. But can
That's
you tell
correct.
Me about your early childhood? Because you were born with a bent spine and had a limp.
Well, my early childhood was really idyllic. My parents were wealthy. My father was incredibly wealthy right up until I was 12 years old. He ran a construction business in Birmingham. He had 3 factories. He came from the Wilcox Lang dynasty. He was a very hardworking man. We had a new Rolls Royce every 6 months. I never knew I was disabled. And I think the thing about disability is you don't know you have it until other people treat you as if you're disabled. So when I was born at home. My mother literally prepared Sunday lunch for the family, my brother and sister and dad. She went into labor at about 11:15. The midwife came and she gave birth to me in her bedroom at 11:45 and was back down with the family by 1 o'clock. So, you know, this is what life was then. And just to reflect back even further, my father was born at a time of high child mortality. So he was one of 13 children and only 3 survived. So there was a toughness about life back then. We didn't have central heating. We very rarely had hot baths until I was about 7. And that was normal, wealthy British life back then. With my disability, I knew something was up because every 6 months I was in hospital, and every morning and night, my mother had to give me physio, which I really enjoyed. This physio included things like painting with my feet, things that I became very expressive with. I could write with my feet. I could paint with my feet. I didn't know that to be called Hopalong by my family was politically incorrect. I thought I was being favored. So
it was the 70s or 60s. I don't know. It was, you know,
it was mainly the 60s. But I was a child of incredible braveness and bravado because I was singled out and I thought I was special. My mother had to buy two pairs of shoes, small pair on my left foot, the larger pair on my right foot. I would fall a lot. I had raises on my left foot built into the shoes. You know, I just had a disability. It really wasn't until I reached the age of 11 when the corrective surgery started that I started to be really pissed off with my body because the corrective surgery didn't work. And up until that point, I was training to be a junior ice skating champion. I trained alongside John Curry, you know, and then suddenly everything kind of went a bit kaput. And I just started to fight against it because I was being labelled and I didn't like it.
Well, that's what I want to come to, because children can be very unempathic.
Yes.
And any difference is highlighted. And at school, if you were any different in any way to other people, then you would be a sort of target and there would be names. And I would think that to a certain extent, that difference would also change you. So how did that being seen as different change you then?
Well, I think I was very liked at school, but also people picked on the speech impediments. And I'm only laughing now because it's only in recent years I've seen with clarity how others saw me. I had no idea, no idea. So I was dyslexic and had a very unique use of language, and it made people laugh. And I would get bullied. I get bullied because I was sensitive. I was easy to make cry. But the most extraordinary abuse I ever had was I was about 4 and a half. And in our class, there was a Wendy house. And two girls would take me into that Wendy house. They would remove their shoelaces and strangle me till I lost consciousness. Now, I didn't know this was abuse. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell the teachers. And then I started to get abused because of the way I sounded rather than the way I moved. And again, I didn't see it as abuse. But one day, after a night of no sleep and anxiety at home, I walked into the class and I picked a chair up and I smashed it over the bully's head. And that changed my life. And after that point, I became a bit of a leader in my school.
I mean, there's different forms of abuse, but that sort of abuse, I mean, you've also got a list, which I have.
Yeah.
And some of these things that we have and we possess and that people see as difference provide a drive in life. And so, in a sense, the negativity can become, later on, you've got to go through the shit, but later on, it can be a positivity. Now, abuse wasn't only from other school children. Your mother was quite abusive, wasn't she?
My mother was severely mentally damaged by a childhood experience, which we only learnt about in 3 years ago. And after her death, when Ancestry.com showed us press cuttings from a court case that involved her when she was about 16, and she'd witnessed her father murder her mother. And my mother was illegitimate, which terrified her. And now putting the pieces together, I can see why my mother was the creature she was. My mother would have been terrified of people discovering not only was she illegitimate, but a member of her family murdered somebody, because my mother was the absolute double of Hyacinth Bouquet from a comedy called Keeping Up Appearances. So as children, we weren't allowed to talk to anyone who had an accent. We weren't allowed to misbehave or even talk in public. She was very strict, and my father was very strict, and my schooling was very strict. But my mother's greatest fear was her history being found out. Now, when my father met my mother, she was touring with a comedian called Max Wall. She was 18. She'd already been chaperoned since the age of 16. And my father never understood why the chaperone was with her 24 hours a day, a female chaperone who was even with her right up till the wedding night. And the chaperone would never let my father be alone with my mother. Well, we've now discovered that my mother's father, who murdered her mother in front of her, got out of prison within 3 months, and the chaperone was there to protect her from her father. So my mother was living in constant fear. She didn't once talk about this in our lifetime, not even to my father, who she was married to, or to my brother and sister. She carried this for the whole of her life. So my mother would fly off the handle with the greatest of ease. She had real emotional difficulty that, as a very beautiful dancer and a woman who was a beauty queen in her teens, had given birth to a daughter with a physical defect. She had a real problem with it. But also, she was abusive in that she couldn't control her emotions. With my sister, who is 8 years older than me, my sister has no memory of her childhood. My brother and I do, because we remember my mother chasing around the house with a carving knife, shouting, "I'm going to kill you." With me, the abuse was she felt I had no future. So every time I achieved something, the abuse started. And the abuse started in the way, oh, don't believe in it. It's not going to happen. When I won in 1982 Best Female Singer in the equivalent of what is the Brits, I phoned her and I said, "I've won." And she said, "Well, don't brag about it. It's not going to continue." And I said, "But I've got this beautiful trophy." "Oh, you will fall on it and it will kill you."
Oh, wow.
So everything to do with happiness, everything to do with joy, everything to do with eating was going to kill us. So as soon as we put food in our mouth, she'd say, "You will choke on it." Every time I said, "I'm going for a walk," "You will be murdered," was the reply. And we ended up, because we're tough children. My parents never knew how they had the children they had. My brother was a Harrier fighter pilot, one of only three to actually fly that plane at that time because it was so complex to fly. My sister, right at the top of the NHS, one of the kind of runners of the accounting in the NHS. And in the July the 7th bombings, my sister is the one that emptied all the double-decker buses, filled them with oxygen, got them into the underground and saved all those people. She made that decision above everyone else. We are tough children. And my parents were the complete opposite.
Oh, that's amazing. My father never loved me. I found this out from my mother after he died.
Yeah.
And she told me that she had a third child to keep him. And of course, because of that, he never had anything to do with me in my early years. And I ended up being a presenter on MTV to get, I presume, what I felt would be love from the whole world, which will compensate not having love from my father. When you hear me say that, and this word compensation, do you instantly know that this is what your fight for a career was as well?
I was loved. I do believe I was loved in their way. My father, I don't know about your dad, but my father had spent 6 years away at war, World War II. And my mother is obviously going through a complete lack of education and a complete lack of support. They love me in their way, but their negativity always baffled me. It broke me. It meant that I could never experience joy because they had programmed me to suffer when I experienced joy. I think my fight for survival is the industry never accepted me on a particularly large level, mostly because I'm minute. I'm barely 5 foot tall, but I'm not proportioned like a model or like Kim Kardashian. So I was always fighting for my presence as a viable woman. And every barrier I come up against, I will push back. I will push that barrier down. And I do think, yes, you're right, that the contribution to that is my upbringing. But also my upbringing taught me to see injustice towards women. And it taught me on a level that is deeply subconscious, because my mother didn't use that language. My mother was breathtakingly beautiful. When she delivered me to my first party with boys when I was 13, the whole room went quiet and a boy said, "I want to snog her," and pointed to my mother. So my mother, her breathtaking beauty got her through her life, but psychologically she was deeply broken.
I mean, one thing, you know, you mentioned that when you got the equivalent of a Brit Award back in 1982, that you called your mother.
Well, I was really calling my dad, but my mother answered the phone.
But it's also looking for confirmation, isn't it?
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, and that's what another thing that we look for in our lives is the wounds that we have in our childhood. We look for the confirmation, but we never get it.
You don't get it. And I got it in a very strange way, that in the 5 days before my mother left this world, she was screaming for me. She only wanted me with her. And my mother had no faith, but my mother could see that I saw something different. And I sat with her for the 5 days, as well as the other family members. But she knew that if I was there, I could help her get through those 5 days and release. Because it's just so bloody obvious, we never stop. Our consciousness is a continual thing. And she only saw that in me, or acknowledged it in the end. And with my father, it was the same. My father wanted me by his bedside, but they acknowledged it in the end.
How difficult has it been for you to touch in your life on this trauma over your life? Because for me, I mean, I'm in trauma therapy now. I've been in therapy, I don't know, I've had 6 or 8 years of therapy previously, and I've now back in therapy for the last 1.5 years, and it's a trauma therapy where it's about how you hold things in your body, and it affected your health because of what happens in your past, and then it's really trying to go deep inside, and it's a very painful process, but it's an important process. But I just wondered how you have dealt with that throughout your life, just with other people, on your own, in therapy.
The one person who saved my life is my husband, Robert Fripp. He just saw it immediately. As soon as he met my mother, he saw the problem. And Robert's had trauma in his life, and I've had trauma, and we sit down and we talk through everything, and we sit down at least for 1 hour to 2 hours a day and just talk. And he helped unravel how I was physically responding to the experiences of negativity. He pointed it out. He said, "What your mother has just said is just not logical. It's not logical." Because I was suicidal after every time I met her, right up, we were fighting until 2 weeks before she died. And my husband would sit me down and say, "You know what she's just said is illogical." Because even he, after knowing her for 30 odd years, she would make him a cup of tea and he'd say, "No milk, no sugar." And she would deliver a cup of tea with milk and sugar. She would do completely the opposite. So I'd say, "Oh, I'm so excited. I'm going to be playing Calamity Jane in a national tour." And she'd say, "Well, it will close in the first week. And if it doesn't, you'll break a bone." And it's illogical. It's absolutely illogical. And I would hit the fucking roof. Because I started fighting back with her when I was 12. And eventually I was sent to live with a gorgeous, gorgeous Hindu family in Edgbaston in Birmingham, who just saw that we were going to kill each other. So we've had a long, long relationship of traumaing each other. But Robert is the one that helped me deal with what I call career abuse, which is ironically the way my family treated me, calling me Hopalong, reflected also in my career with critics and reviews and general comments in showbiz press. It reflected, it was there. It was as if I was showing it on my shoulders. And Robert and I will often sit down and talk about why would a reviewer lie? We had a review once from playing the Roundhouse with our band called The Humans, which we volunteered to open a festival at 6 p.m., knowing that the tickets said it started at 7 p.m. And a reviewer said that no one was there to see us. They decided not to come till 7 p.m. The music was awful. And the reviewer wasn't even in the fucking room. So we've always had to deal with dishonesty in the press. And we talk about it a lot. And I would say more so as a creative human being, my relationship with dishonesty in the performance field, I've had to deal with more than my parents. And it's only since my parents have passed and that I learned my mother's history that I've been putting two and two together as to why I was treated the way I was treated. And actually, it's given me a feeling of being very well grounded, that my survival instincts kicked in. And I just see that the problem was theirs. It wasn't mine. It was nothing to do with my disability. It was nothing to do with the fact that I'm small. Small people do get kicked. It was, I am a survivor anyway. You know, I'm a strong person.
I mean, you just said that you moved in with a Hindu family. I remember because my father, he left when I was about 13. But before that, there were enormous rows. He was a market trader. He would throw money. And to be honest, we had these wooden panels that looked a bit like East Germany after the war, eventually, because they would be pockmarked because of all the money flying around. And I remember going around a friend's house and his mum and dad sat on the sofa holding hands. And I said to him, what are they doing?
Yeah.
And because my only vision of a relationship was this dysfunctional, horrendous. I mean, I didn't see them in the early days when I presume they were in love. But I only saw them in the period, when I was there. And and it's very hard not seeing and not having that feeling of love that you obviously didn't have from your mother when she was alive.
I did have love. But there was part of her that was so broken, it was like a split personality. So she did give love and she did protect, but it came with extreme outbursts of very confusing anger and despair. Now, I said that my parents were very, very wealthy till I was 12. And when I was 12, my father lost the entire family business in a stock market slump. And we went from having Rolls Royces to having no food by Friday. And I think one of the reasons I am such a survivor and I'm so educated and I self-educate about everything from money to investing to stocks and shares is I saw my parents lose everything. So by the time I was 14, I was lying to get work. So I could bring money into the house. But what really destroyed my parents, and you've got to keep in mind that my mother was living a lie anyway about social status. For them to lose their money, they lost their social status. And very wonderful people stepped in and gave them money. One is still alive. He's my uncle, not a blood uncle, but we call him uncle. And he's 100 this year. And he stepped in, very wealthy man, and gave them a fund to live off. Then I started working and I started to be able to fund them. Eventually, I bought the family home off them and then I bought them a new home. I was giving them more money a week than I was earning when I was at the height of my fame. They were in that much shit financially. to watch two people be destroyed who were so hooked on social status taught me a lot. And it meant that when I was being knocked and being criticized and being treated like the cheap version of Kate Bush in the press, I had to survive. I had to keep my parents alive. I had to keep them in a home. And it did nothing but make me tougher and more determined and more self-aware of how utterly fucking brilliant and unique I am. I'm the toughest you can ever meet. And that's what my upbringing did to me.
That's wonderful. I think that power that you have because of that is incredible. The 70s were an era of not that everything has changed, but they were an era of unbelievable sexism, misogyny, racism,
yes,
and homophobia. I mean, they were everything. And I was 13 in 1972, so we were sort of the same age, yeah. I think. And as a gay teenager, along came David Bowie, and suddenly there was this world where I felt I could belong.
Yeah.
And David Bowie played a sort of similar role in your life.
David Bowie, his career trajectory was a gift to every artist because, boy, he struggled. He really struggled from up to Space Oddity. He was just struggling to find his place. He was obviously a phenomenal creative. Then after Space Oddity, he had to deal with prog rock coming in, heavy rock coming in. It confused his writing. But I think The Man Who Sold the World is one of his best albums. And then he found his place within Ziggy Stardust, working with, finding Mick Ronson, working with Tony Visconti. There's a producer called Scott, well, I can't remember his full name, who really brought Bowie out. That career trajectory that then brought him into the most remarkable 10 years of any artist's life is utterly inspiring to someone who wants to create something new every time they write, but would really like commercial success with it. Bowie never let go of what he believed in, and that was himself.
I mean, one thing that was really very particular about Bowie was the fact that everything he did was imbued with different cultural aspects, from books to art to dance to mime, you name it, it's all in there. Yeah. When I first, you know, encountered Bowie on the television, as it were, as a teenager, I wasn't aware of all those factors. It was only later, as I got to know his music and then realized there were other, you know, including like William Burroughs' Cut Up Technique or whatever, there was other things within it. When did you become aware that there were so many cultural things within his music?
Well, I think the NME and the Rock Record Mirror, they made it all very clear with excellent interviews with Bowie around 1972, possibly 71. And those magazines circulated in my girls' school. But there was a brilliant Alan Yentob BBC documentary on Bowie, which explored his writing process. And by this time, he was already the man who fell to earth.
That was Cracked Actor, wasn't it, I think?
Cracked Actor. Absolutely, yep. Brilliant. And at that point, he really ignited the potential in me because I never fitted in. I didn't fit in with the education system because of my dyslexia and dyspraxia. But I saw a way I could fit in. And he introduced me to more literature than my school did. The literature he read was high class. But only recently I've got into a surrealist artist called Leonora Carrington. And she put a play on called Penelope about 1934. And the male lead has Ziggy Stardust makeup on. And I only discovered this 2 months ago, and I ran to my husband with the picture and I said, it's either 1934 or 1954, Ziggy Stardust. This is how he got his makeup. He got it from a surrealist artist called Leonora Carrington. And I just thought that is just so brilliant. He was a fisher of culture. He threw the fishing rod out with the hook, pulled it back, and he made it work for him.
What culture were you into? What books were you into as a teenager?
All the typical ones. Lord of the Rings, which took me about 3 years to read. That led me on to The Hobbit. That led me on to all of J.R.R. Tolkien's writings. A girl I went to school with called Angela Power, her father was Canon Power, and he wrote similar literature to J.R.R. Tolkien. And his books didn't break, but these books were wonderful. And he used to give me his books, and I love them. I was also reading Mary Stuart, which is kind of romantic, legendary mythology. But I really loved the darker stuff. And if I could pick up a Dennis Wheatley book from the library, then I would. So I loved things that led on to the culture of dragons and Dungeons and Dragons and all of that culture. I really loved it. But I also loved Black Sabbath. I loved Hawkwind. I went to Uriah Heep, didn't quite get the music, but I loved being in that audience. And I was only 11. I used to break into these venues. I love Moody Blues, and I probably would have loved King Crimson if I knew they were playing. And there were probably many times I'd broken into venues where my husband was in that venue.
And how did you break in?
I would get someone going in through the front, and I'd say, please go around the back. There's a fire escape. Just open it. I'll get in quickly and close the door. Well, there'd always be about 20 of us there. And it's a habit we kept going when we were touring as punk rockers. We would let people in at the fire exit once we'd sold enough tickets to pay our expenses. It was a culture back then, the fire escape entrance. People were very generous and they'd let us in.
One thing that I read about is that you experienced a ghost. I don't think this is the way to go, or sort of another being, whatever, something from the other side in your bedroom.
Yeah.
When you used to communicate.
Yeah. Very special.
Yeah. Can you tell me about that? Because when I had an experience when I was 45.
Oh,
you know,
good.
Later. And I was in this hotel in Luxembourg, actually.
Yeah.
And this family used to visit me every night, and eventually I had to move out because it so freaked me out. And I couldn't communicate with them.
Tell me what they looked like. How many of them were there?
It was a nuclear family. It was two parents and two kids, and they would hold on to them a bit like sort of the American picture.
What year was it?
This would have been 2001.
2001.
And I just wondered that if that hotel was on something or whatever, but no one... You know, everyone thought I was a nutter by saying it the next day. No one wanted to believe me. And so I really found it fascinating that you'd also had that sort of similar experience.
Geographically, where were you?
I was in Luxembourg.
Oh, that's very interesting. Okay. If you told me you were in Seattle or you're in Minnesota, I would have said it was a shaman coming to teach you a lesson. The most extraordinary one, and I will get back to your question. We used to live and write with a musician called Bill Rieflin, who was the drummer in REM, and I had a band called The Humans with. The month he was diagnosed with his terminal cancer, I was at his house in the spare bedroom, and I was woken up by a Caucasian man. Am I allowed to say that word? A white man. I was woken up. Came through the window, he was in a loincloth, woke me up, and he said, I come to teach you how to die. And I said, okay. And he said, it's like peeling off the layers of an onion. When you die, you will go through a process where each layer of your life comes off, and the purity of your soul is all that's left. And I woke up and I thought, what the fuck was that about? And I told Bill, and Bill was then diagnosed with terminal bowel cancer. And it freaked Bill out. It really freaked Bill out because I don't think he believed in the afterlife. But I realize now that the shaman, the energy of the shaman, I could pick up, but Bill couldn't. And the lesson was for Bill. So sometimes you meet these experiences because they're lessons, which is why I've just told you that story. Okay, with me, I was 14 and my sister, my father, and I always had very bad poltergeist experiences, which freaked my mother out. My mother used to lock herself in a room at night because she didn't want to hear what was going on. My sister, who's 8 years older than me, was training at Dudley Road Hospital in Birmingham, and they train the nurses then by putting them in the terminal cancer wards. And my sister was emotionally destroyed by this, but it made her very strong. And she would come home in tears because her favourite patient would have passed away. Well, one night, all chaos broke out in the house when my sister was woken up because the duvet was flying around the room. Then my father was woken up because his duvet was flying around the room. And with me, my bedroom door was slamming. Now, we went through a period of about 4 years where the house was like this. We experienced things like the wallpaper just flying off the walls, soaking wet. My mother felt that I was the nucleus. I actually think my sister was. She felt that I was the nucleus because I'd never been christened. So I then went into religious education, and I was then confirmed by the Archbishop of Canterbury. I was locked away for 3 weeks until I was christened and confirmed. And then slowly it started, I wouldn't say stop, it became under control. And when I was about 14, I had something that would be explained as a dream, but it's the most tangible thing I've ever experienced in my life. And I've had this experience 4 times, and I yearn for this experience because it's as if the layers were taken off me and the true part of me was taken out to be taught something. And you read about this a lot. A lot of people have had this experience. It is, I think, part of, the word will come to me, but it's part of a culture. It's a cultural, mythological, repeating experience throughout time. I woke up, and at the end of the bed was about a 9-foot-tall silver man. And he was standing in a breeze. Everything was moving. His hair was moving. His clothes were moving. And he was incredibly thin. And he was dressed in long gowns. And he put his hands out and he said, come with me. And I lifted out of my body and he took my hand. We traveled right through the window and we kept traveling. And the stars were zipping by, zip, 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 zip. And we suddenly stopped at a gas nebulae. And we went into the gas nebulae, and there were these huge, colorful spheres, the most beautiful colors I've ever seen. And they passed through each other. And as they did, they made different notes. Within this space was a monolithic building. Absolutely monolithic, 3 towers. I don't know why that was there, but I do know that the spheres were souls. And he said, this is your true self. This is your soul. And then he brought me back, put me back into my body. The next time he came, I was about 15. And this is where it's really strange, because I'm dyslexic. He took me out of my body exactly the same way. He took me up into the stars, but this time into the blackness amongst the stars. And he gave me an equation lesson. He says, I want you to learn this equation. And he wrote it out. There was algebra, there was pi, there was everything. And I remember thinking, why the hell are you teaching me this? I can't do maths or algebra. And then he brought me back. So skip right forward to the age of 45. He came back here to this house and he just stood at the edge of the bed and he said, are you okay? It was astonishing. And every time this happened, I felt more real and more in place than I do in this body.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join MyLowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Have you been around someone at the moment of death?
Yes. My mother. Yes. It can be a very beautiful experience. If the person is willing to let go, it's very beautiful. And because I've been in hospices with people who've died, the nurses have the same experience. You see a transition and you know that the consciousness is there for at least 14 hours. But the nurses say, open the windows, let the soul free itself. It's very important at that point that we accept we need to leave this body. It's like watching a mirage.
Yeah, no, I was very close to my mother in the end, and I spent many years as her carer, and the last 2 weeks had a hospital bed in the front room, and I slept next to her and did everything that a carer does, and it was incredibly tough to witness the death of someone that you love so much. But at the same time, it had these aspects to it, and one of them really threw me completely, because my mother used to sit in a chair and watch the birds in the garden, you know, like a lot of old people do, and that would be her sort of favorite occupation, and all the birds she liked came back on the day she died, and it was really bizarre and it was noticeable, and for me that was just sort of a moment where the environment in which we live connects to us on the deepest level.
It does. It really does. We're just not encouraged to see what's going on around us. And also, the loss is tougher for you. I believe once you're in the process of going, you understand what the process is. And I think, you know, we are hardwired for survival in this biological body. And that's our experience. I mean, personally, I have absolutely no fear of death. I only fear how I die.
Yeah, no, I'm exactly the same. Dave Simpson wrote a book on the Sex Pistols, and I interviewed him not long ago. And in that book, there's this wonderful quote from you, where you'd gone to see them at Bogart's in Birmingham in September 1976. And you said, it was fantastic. I'd already dyed my hair bright pink and I was wearing bin liners because I couldn't afford clothes. I'd been ridiculed for the way I looked, but I walked into the club and suddenly I wasn't alone anymore.
It was a tribe. I walked in and I thought, where have you all been in my life? Because I'd been making my own clothes since I was 12. By this time, I was probably 15 or 16. And I'd always been ridiculed on the street for looking different. I was a hair model. So I used to have different colour hair every week. And even though I was still at school, I looked outlandish. And I walked into Bogart's and it was like, there's 350 people who all look similar to me, not uniform, but they all had made their own clothes and all had different coloured hair. And I thought, my goodness, why have I never met you?
That's amazing. Fabulous. So this was the community that you were looking for, in a sense.
Yeah, it very much was the community, but also it sparked something quite competitive in me, in that, you know, these people look really good and they look really sophisticated, some of them. And I was thinking, I want to look like that. I want to take this further. None of us knew how to behave at the gig. We didn't really understand what pogoing was. So we just stood there and were kind of ingesting what we were seeing. And Johnny Rotten found us profoundly boring and kept going off stage. But we were just learning. We were there. We were eager. We were hungry. And we were learning what this new movement was. And it was extraordinary.
I mean, so many artists you know, and he really notices it in his book. So many artists, and there's this famous Manchester gig, and so many artists had seen the Sex Pistols, and it was the moment that they decided they wanted to do that in some form, you know, their own version of that. And that was it with you.
Yeah, exactly. I saw what looked like a pretty ramshackle performance, full of energy, full of excitement and incredible attitude. But I saw it and I thought, I can do that. I'm going to do that. This is what I'm going to be. It was very releasing, considering I'd come from a background where people were really accentuating that I wasn't pretty, I wasn't tall, I wasn't slim, I was never going to fit into show business. I suddenly saw how I could do it. I saw my place. And that was amazing. Because having seen Bowie and Bowie do Ziggy Stardust, you were looking at a bird of paradise. You were looking at the most perfect, most complete human being you've ever seen. But then you looked at the Sex Pistols and they were performing as broken people. And I thought, I can do it. I can do it. It was fabulous.
I mean, one of the things about that era, which I always... I mean, I remember because I think it affected me such a lot. Not only was I was also a hair model, I was also dyeing my hair, you know, getting it dyed different colours and stuff.
Yeah.
But as a gay man, you know, I got beaten up by the police coming out of a gay nightclub, snogging some guy. I got beaten up by football supporters. All these events.
Yeah.
And for being different, having different coloured hair, being a different sexuality, and you also define yourself as a third
gender,
don't you? Yeah.
Yeah.
But being different was being a target in that era.
Yeah.
How did that make you feel?
Well, I'm very sorry you went through that, but one of the most extraordinary experiences of me being saved, I was walking down the King's Road about 1977, and some football fans beat up the gay boy I was with. He was called Howard. He's a boy because he was a boy. I'm not using slang. Very beautiful boy. And they beat him up. And then I was protecting him. So they started to try and throw both of us through a glass window, a big sheet of glass. And they were flinging us at it. Derek Jarman saw this happen because he had an exhibition at World's End. He got a broken chair leg. He ran out of the exhibition across the King's Road and started to hit the shit out of the football fans and save us. It was extraordinary. Gentle, beautiful Derek Jarman, who I'd never seen be physical with anyone, was beating the fucking shit out of these footballers, dragged us back to the exhibition and looked after us.
Oh, well, I love him even more.
Yeah, you know, made me love him even more. I used to get laughed at, but buses in Birmingham wouldn't let me on the bus. And a very common thing you'd hear, what are you, a fucking clown? Taxi drivers wouldn't give me a lift. But extraordinarily, when I moved to London, walking down Oxford Street, I'd get spat at because women from other cultures just could not understand why a woman was dressed this way. They instantly thought I was a sex worker or something. And they just would spit at us. They'd throw dog shit at us if they could. It was extraordinary because I was dressed like that. And I thought, I'm really quite a nice person. I want to get to know people. I want friends. I don't want to dress like this to make enemies. And that was quite a dilemma for me. But the aggression was extraordinary. But it also created my career because directors wanted to meet me. Directors knew that I wasn't afraid to be experimental and wasn't afraid to do different things on stage or to look what a very beautiful actress would be called looking demeaning or bad. It didn't scare me. So it led to my career.
It's the Jean Genet tub of Vaseline, isn't it? That Jean Genet had a tub of Vaseline in his prison cell and the prison guards would beat him up. And he realised that this object had power. And this is what pop stars are able to use, because they have their objects, which can be their words, their image, their music, and that is their power. And that was your power. And that was probably the, you know, a moment where you realized that power as well.
Absolutely. Am I a power player? I'm incredibly emphatic, empathetic. How do you say it?
Empathic, I think.
Empathic. Yeah. So I don't like to hurt people. I don't like aggression. But because of my past, if people try to do either hurt me or be aggressive towards me, they meet a tidal wave of kind of well-practiced self-survival. But I really like to be part of a team, and I like to be a good friend, and I like to be supportive. But sometimes when I stand on a stage where you're in front of an audience who haven't specifically come to see you, like big festivals, then I can turn that power on.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard you talk about stories where your anger has been incredibly excessive, if I can use that word. It's been enormous. Have you, over the years, have you sort of understood that and been able to live with it rather than actually try to deal with it? Do you see what I mean, the difference?
I haven't done therapy because my husband is really the greatest person I can talk to. And I hope I'm as big a help to him as he is to me. I don't really bottle things up. But what I really enjoy doing in a really perverse way, that there are certain types of kind of snobby literati types who will always attack me. And my passive anger, violent response, I love. I really get off on. It gives me the deepest thrill to walk in front of them and be fucking amazing. It really does. And they don't know that they're feeding my ambition. And that probably has come from my childhood.
You have had these two distinct passions in your life, from acting and performing, singer and so on. How did they work at the start? Because you said you saw the Sex Pistols and that's what you wanted to be. That was it. But you were at drama school, I presume, at that time.
Yeah, I was at drama school studying plays, dancing and stage singing. My acting career took off way before my music career, but my heart was in music. And that's a youthful choice. I knew if I was going to be the musician I wanted to be, it had to start as soon as possible. I was spotted because to be a punk rocker back then was really rare. And people were talking about this girl on the streets of Birmingham who was dressing in her own clothes and had peacock hair. And two brothers called the BCAC brothers heard about me, and they're a playwright and a musical writer. And they worked together doing their own stage and TV plays. And they ended up tracking me down and casting me in a play about a girl who wanted to be on Top of the Pops and breaks into the Top of Pop studios. That led to me writing two songs with a band called Bilbo Baggins for the TV filming. And that led to me joining the National Theatre, which led to me being able to form a band.
That was Glitter, which is actually, you can see this wonderful excerpt on YouTube, which I managed to hunt out, which is really good. And your character lusts after Midura.
And I'm not good in this play. I'm a rough diamond. I've never been on camera before. But by coincidence, Kate Nelligan, the actress, watched it when it broadcast 3 months later and said to the superstar German film star Maximilian Schell, who was directing her at the National Theatre, "I want that girl to play Emma in Tales from the Vienna Woods." And 4 weeks later, I was living in London, socialising with Brenda Bletham, Warren Clark, many, many more, Elizabeth Spriggs. I was launched immediately, Stephen Berkoff, immediately into the glitterati of London theatre. I had I think, 5 astonishing years where angels were just throwing stardust in front of my feet. And I managed to form the band and get a recording deal and build a huge audience.
I mean, that was it. You were in Jubilee, you were in Tempest. You were in so many acting roles that gave you an enormous profile.
Yeah.
But you were clearly an absolute workaholic, weren't you?
I still am. And back then, it was really frowned on to do both acting and singing. Actors, if an actor did a voiceover or a TV advert, they would never work again in theatre. It was that bad. And theatre actors didn't talk to film actors. Film was considered the worst back then. So it was quite renaissance to do both. And I'm a workaholic. And you've got to remember, I was supporting my parents financially. And, you know, making money and being creative were almost equal, because making money represented survival for my family. I loved every bit of work I ever did. I've really loved it. I love the closed environment of a film set. I really did like working at the Royal Court and the ICA and those highly prestigious theatres. And I loved being on stage with a mad punk audience pogoing away. I felt really lucky.
Were you someone that was really concentrated on developing yourself and your knowledge of the things that you were involved in, or were you just living?
Oh, no, I was in full development, and I still am. And part of that is because of my physicality. I always have to work on my physicality. I always have to keep my legs working. That's just something to do with the journey from my brain to my legs. So I'm always working on my physicality. I will never, ever get to a stage where I'm as physically controlled as someone like, let's say, Madonna or Lizzo or anyone that uses dance in their musical interpretation, because I do have disability. And also with my memory, I have a very strange memory. I can tell you, you could stand outside a door in London and I'll tell you the address. I have visual memory. Oh, it's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. I can tell you exactly what I was wearing 12 months ago to the day. And I can tell you that right up until I was about 15. But tell me your name or tell me a fact in literature, I have to keep relearning. For me, when I'm writing songs, I have to keep relearning the 8 notes, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. There's something not in that neural journey going on. So I have a phenomenal experience of a knowledge of some things. And on basics, I am permanently frustrated that I cannot remember faces and names. So I know this, so I can work with it, and I can do the exercises I need to do to keep the neural connections. But I will always be learning, and that's because of how my body is.
So you're in London. You've done these, been involved in these amazing stage plays and in these films, and in your heart is still music. How did you then move? Well, you didn't move because you're still doing those other things. How did the music part then come about?
Well, it was tough. And I put the toughness down to my physicality. When record companies came to see a female singer, they wanted to lust after her. When I made Quadrophenia, I made a conscious effort to lose about 3 stone in weight and change my appearance. And that was because up until that point, I'd had 2 years of us not being signed to a record label. And we'd built up, we had enough for a set, we were doing regular touring, we were drawing 2,000 kids into pubs. They couldn't fit in. They were surrounding pubs, yet we were still not being signed. And I made a very physical decision that I was going to have to change my appearance so people saw me differently. And during Quadrophenia, the filming, I was also making Quatermass with Sir John Mills. So I was working day and night. And I just took a lot of speed and I lost 3 stone. And that helped me readdress how the industry saw me, because by the time I started gigging again after making Quadrophenia, I was a completely physically different person.
That also made you ill, didn't it?
Oh, God, I was so ill. So ill. I mean, I think the longest I've ever been without sleep was 10 days. And the longest I've ever been without food and water was 3 days. And I was on a 2-week shoot of Quadrophenia while working at Wembley Stadium on Quatermass. And my agent didn't put 2 and 2 together that I was actually working 24 hours. So I wasn't eating and I wasn't sleeping. And the makeup lady was watching me get smaller and smaller and my clothes hanging off me. And I coughed. I had a very bad cough. And she saw blood in what was coming up. And she literally slammed down her brushes, grabbed my wrist and said, I'm taking you to hospital now. And she walked me round the corner to where is the Langan Hotel on Hyde Park Corner. That was a hospital. She walked me straight in and she said, test this girl now. And I had pneumonia. So I was put on antibiotics and lots of things to support my lungs. And I carried on working for 24 hours.
I mean, pneumonia takes a long time to get over.
Yeah, and it scars your lungs. But I just carried on. I carried on with taking speed and just working 24 hours. See, I love that. I absolutely love it. I love that, you know, athletes run 24 miles. I can't do that, but I can push my body to work hard.
You were really in the epicenter of music at that point, because you were in a warehouse, weren't you? It was this Mayhem warehouse, and lots of musicians were hanging around. Tell me about that and tell me how it felt, because in a sense, they were already successful or making it.
Yeah.
You hadn't been at that point.
Well, I was cult. I was definitely ascending. But, you know, the people that gave great reviews to most of the bands didn't review me kindly. But I had an audience. What made me impossible to ignore was my audience was enormous, and also my output was enormous. So Mayhem was a British Rail warehouse, which we converted into a venue. We weren't supposed to. It's completely illegal. A man called Keith was the main developer and keeper of it, and I kind of came in as a rent payer investor. Adam Ant's wife, Eve, was there. And a music journalist from the NME, John Herlihy, was there, and his brother Kevin. And we ran this place, and it became incredibly popular. Steve Strange would take it over from Fridays to Mondays for 4-day parties. Spandau Ballet did their first gig there. Iggy Pop rehearsed The Idiot there. John Cale was there. Bowie came to visit. It was very, very successful. It was grotty, it was dirty, it was cold, it was dark. It had one toilet. It was totally underground. And it ran and ran and ran. It's now been knocked down. And when it was about to be knocked down, there was protest that it should be preserved because of the history of it.
I mean, earlier when we talked about the Sex Pistols, you said this was your community. When people came to see you in pubs, and you know, at the early days, this 2,000 to 3,000 people would come.
Yeah.
What do you think they saw you as? Was it also their community?
Yeah. I think what they saw in me, I mean, I was definitely fancied by the boys and girls, that all that was going on. But I think they saw the underdog that made good. I was brought up within my family as an underdog. And I think to a certain extent in the industry, you know, that still goes on a little bit. But I think the fans that I talked to had similar childhood experiences to you and me. And, you know, people that were too scared to come out as gay, people who totally identified with my not wanting to be identified at all as a gender, because it led to me being belittled because I wasn't supermodel, but, you know, I wasn't pretty and slim. You know, it meant my gender meant I was being undermined and criticized for the way God made me. So when they came to my shows, I think it gave them strength to answer back. It gave them strength to believe in themselves, believe in their instinctive internal voice, which is our true voice, and follow who and what they are meant to be and not be told to be something else by others. And that's always been my message. And I believe that's how I built my audience.
What were you learning on the way to have sort of the success that you had by playing these gigs? What were you actually learning, and what was lacking in terms of your thinking, okay, in order to get to the next stage, I need this and this?
I've always been my worst enemy, always, because I would never do the obvious. And there were times if I did the obvious, I could have prolonged experiences. When Anthem came out, which huge album, gold, multi-seller. There's obviously six singles on that album, but we decided it would exploit fans if we released more than two off the album. If we went with four singles, we could have prolonged that success into putting me into arenas. And I've never, ever really gone that way. I've always gone against formulaic ways of moving, formulaic ways of writing. So every album I'd have a different style. Now I realize I was my own worst enemy by doing that. And I can see that now when I create, that what people want and need from me and my natural way of creating music and writing is to do it with energy. I am not a balladeer. I'm not a love song person. I'm a person that you come into the room to see, to have your energy lifted. So it's taken me a long time to see, respect, trust, and honor that. When I was a lot younger, I would just go off on tangents that confused the industry. So I'd make an album, then I'd go and do a stage play. I'd then go and do a film. You know, I was always moving because I felt each of those communities were making me more creative. I think it did work with me. I think it's made me a more interesting artist, but I needed to learn what the industry needed at a certain level.
What was it about Joel Borgen that you connected with, and him with you? What was this sort of symbiotic relationship in terms of writing?
The word symbiotic is exactly what worked between us. We had a great understanding, like brother and sister. Joel and I mean, I've never laughed as much as when I was with Joel. And perhaps there's similarities with Joel to his upbringing and to my upbringing, but also to how people physically responded to us. I think there were similarities. I have no idea why Joel trusted me or even liked me. No idea, because we never had those kind of in-depth conversations. But we were very, very creative together. And we were creative in a way neither of us expected to go. Joel loved jazz. I loved energy and expression and performance. And I think it made us create something very unique. I think Sheep Farming in Barnet is one of the best albums on the planet. Blue Meaning is stunning. It's stunning. Anthem, recognized, stunning. And one album that did well, but not as well as Anthem, Love is the Law, and also Changeling. But Love is the Law, it's a breathtaking album. And we can hear that influence in the rest of the 80s. We definitely were influential. And I think with Joel and I, part of it came from the fact that we laughed so much. And I have a similar relationship with my current co-writer, Simon Darlow, that we go into a room and things happen. And it's a deeper experience. It's not a formulaic experience. It's to do with whatever that base chakra is, it connects. We have a kind of bond that connects and things happen. I've been in writing situations with many great writers and just think, what am I going to do? There's no chemistry. There's no chemistry. And then you find someone and the chemistry is irresistible. And I think it's, you know, a deeper psychic animal instinct level.
You said at the beginning of this interview that Robert Fripp saved you.
Yeah.
Where were you mentally in your life then when you met him?
Okay. Before I met Robert, there was no one in my life that could explain the psychology of my relationship with my mother. So I was in a really bad place. My mother would call me a slag because I'd had three boyfriends. You know, you're a slag. When are you going to get married? You're a slag. And so I had nothing and no one protecting my self-identity. Joel tried. There were situations where Joel had to protect me. Nigel Glockher, the drummer on Anthem, definitely protected me. But when he left, I felt that my world had gone because I was totally alone. I was living in a situation where I was in permanent fear. And Joel did what he could to protect me. And Robert came along. Robert had heard from the management my living conditions. And Robert bought me a ticket to America. He said, pack a bag, a car will be waiting around the corner and you're not going back. And he really helped me from day one. He helped me. It was a violent and very unsettling time. It put my parents' lives in danger. It put everyone's lives in danger who knew me. And I stayed in America till it was safe to come back.
He instantly knew that you were the one, didn't he? He instantly
knew. He knew immediately. Said, yeah, he knew before the 3 weeks when he met me. He said, because he was living in New York, he said, my diary's empty. I'm going back to the UK. I'm going to meet my wife. He knew. So Robert, you know, you may think I'm wacky in the experiences I've had. Robert is exactly the same. He's exactly the same. He's had the same psychic and spiritual experiences.
And so if he saved you, did you save him?
That's only a question he can ask. I think I'm a handful for him. I think the way Robert looks on it is I'm his spiritual work, because Robert comes from a background where you work on things that make you uncomfortable. You work on things that you disagree with. I think I'm his spiritual work, but you'd have to ask him that question.
Because this year you're also going to be playing at the Isle of Wight, aren't you?
We're doing everything this
Which
year.
Is amazing. No, but the Isle of Wight is a big one, isn't it? It's
There's an one. Even... You can't broadcast this. Do you edit any of this?
No, so tell me afterwards when I turned it off.
We're doing the biggest.
I've got it already.
Not been announced yet.
Oh, wow.
but believe me, to be invited back to the Isle of Wight, because I played it last year and it changed my career. We were broadcast on Sky Arts. It changed everything. It was a magical performance. The camera work was fantastic. The audience were rammed. You could see them. We were in the big top, which takes a good 8,000. You could see them rammed all the way outside. It was a magical day, and we've been invited back.
You said also during this interview that the critics would be very mean to you. You know, the I think
well, they tried.
Yeah, okay, over the years.
There's certain types that are just mean and victimize anyway, but I won a lot of critics over. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted
you. Well, no, it's just that today, you know, you mentioned the Isle of Wight gig last year, and that today, do you feel that all that past has been overcome and you're now seen in the way that you should be seen as someone who was really responsible for the wave of the 80s in so many ways, musically, visually, your attitude, the female power, sorry, the third gender power.
That's fine, that's fine.
even I'm getting confused now, and so on. But do you feel that, you know, this, that you are now at the point where that respect and that love has finally really showed itself in a grown-up way, let's say?
Well, it's lovely to be acknowledged, and it's lovely. There's definitely a sense of relief in certain areas. A lot of very powerful female writers have picked up on my career journey and have made good. The Guardian has been remarkable to me in the last 3 years. Remarkable. Robert and I now have another hurdle that both of us have to face, and that is we're being seen working together. Our social media, Sunday Lunch and Upbeat Moments, is phenomenally popular and it is really well loved. But we now want to bring to the stage a really perfect rock show. And it's, I think that this year is going to be a year of having to reprove ourselves in many ways, even though both of us are at the height of our artistry. I never feel settled. I never feel I've arrived, and I never feel I've been accepted. But that doesn't matter, because as an actress, those are wonderful, wonderful things to have in the back of your head while you're creating a character. It would be lovely to just feel, oh, I've made it. But I don't feel that, and I'm not sure I ever will. But when people acknowledge us as creative artists, and in America for the first time during lockdown and now, we're viewed as performance artists in a really respectful way, that it's very satisfying. It is satisfying.
Well, I find it wonderful. I mean, and I wish you really continued success. And I love your story, because it's tough. And it's hard, and it's got these really sort of deep moments in it that are tough to hear, actually. But it has created you, and in the last few years, and I think because the world has changed, thank God, and it's opened up and people much more aware, I think this is the era, in a sense, where you are now allowed,
yeah,
finally, to be Toya. And Toya has been, as I said, you've been a big part of my life. And at the end, I just want to thank you for your creative contribution to our culture, because it's been massive. And you're also a lovely person.
Well, I mean, thank you, Steve. Thank you so much. What I will say is, love was always there, but love and hate are two very close partners. And I think sometimes people just love you in the wrong way. And when I experience violence in my life, it's because of jealousy from someone else, or when with my parents, is they just didn't know how to love, but they believed they were loving me. And that's where forgiveness comes from.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting.
It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively to Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.